Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Well, hello, friends.
Brian Brushwood.
Yo-ho, second week from the new studio. I can't believe it.
And Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hey, everybody, that's me.
Well, well, well. What a weekend it was if you're a fan of things that are awesome.
Yeah, well, for example, I got my Magic Spoon cereal that you recommended last week on the podcast. I look forward to having some cereal. I watched The Good Place came out. I watched that.
I went to TwitchCon. I met so many cool people.
Bryce,
I did a lot of work.
Ooh, yeah, no. So you got a lot of fulfillment out of doing something that matters.
We got work done.
This is what I love about this show is my friends. Sometimes we fight each other over picks, you know, we want to get it in before the other guy. Here, these guys are letting me save the biggest news, even though they're bursting to tell you about it.
I mean, I don't think anything else happened. I mean, Righteous Gemstones was good last night. There was the last episode of Preacher. That was fun.
They know they want to share it, but I'm going to be the one to share it. SpaceX revealed the Starship.
Oh!
Go to SpaceX.com right now, and you're going to see something really cool. In the upper tab, they list their fleet. You know, they got a fleet of different craft. And they now have a tab for Starship. And they did – Elon Musk did the reveal on Saturday. They did this from Texas, Boca Chica. And we're looking at video of this right now. And they had drone shots of this, whatever. He unveiled the plan, said, hey, this is Mark One. And, man – the design's gone through a lot of changes, but this looks like the form they're going to try to go with. And what he unveiled was the prototype, and this is actually designed to go up to about 20 kilometers, 65,000 feet. It has three engines in it, three Raptor engines. Elon thinks in a month or two they're actually going to send this thing up. Won't go to space, but it's going to go test. This is going to test the maneuver for this thing to come back to Earth. It's a different way than they've brought their first stage boosters back. This has these four aerodynamic surfaces that are going to let it sort of fall like a skydiver and sort of just basically adjust very, very quickly and then come back to Earth and then land. This is the rocket that's basically planning, you know, the plans are for this system to be what we go to Mars, the moon. Even they showed images of this thing going to Saturn.
Look, we will talk about all the amazing, cool things about it, but some part of my brain can't let go of the fact that if somebody told me this is the spaceship of the future, I would laugh at them because it's the most cartoonishly obvious Buck Rogers design from the fact that, you know, because it's a prototype, all of the stainless steel is a little bit kind of warped, so it looks a little bit like a science project wrapped in tin foil. And to the way that it takes off and lands like it's a 1930s Buck Rogers model, like everything about this, I can't believe, like, we're not only living in the future, we're living in the most obviously ripped off from 100 years ago version of the future.
This one, which for the prototyping, they're not using the more advanced methods they're going to use to weld the steel and all that. If you told me that this was, oh, that's a farmer who loves science fiction, that's his grain silo.
Yes.
I'd be like, yeah, no, that's a rocket. I'm like, what? I don't know. So if you look at this thing, as Brian points out, you see like this steel is like basically – This version is not designed to go into space. They're starting building in a month or two the versions. They're going to be building a lot of versions of this because they did a big shift. We talked a lot about how originally they were going to use carbon fiber composite materials, and you know then we heard about like tanks, possible carbon fiber tanks exploding, and then the scale of stuff. Only a year ago, they said, you know what? They looked. There's a type of steel which is very good with high temperatures. It is really strong at low temperatures, which meant that it was actually going to be an ideal material to build your spaceship out of, because a big part of what you have to do is you have to keep these cryogenically cooled fuels inside of there, and certain materials become very brittle. So they found a steel that was about 2% the cost of carbon fiber. And they said, well, let's shift to this. Makes more sense. We have these really next generation heat tiles. They're going to use those. So they shifted that production. And part of the advantage of using steel is we know tons about welding steel, how to make steel and all that. And then Elon, during his, I really recommend you guys get a chance, check out when he does the announcement, because, you know, there's somebody, I forget, like a reporter from CBS or somebody is like, hey, so, because they're in this Boca Chica facility where they're standing next to like two prefab. I mean, these are like party rental tents almost kind of thing. They're structured to use, but they're not like full on aluminum sided stuff or whatever. This is no 7-inch.
I don't even want to say a full step up from what you saw at the Fire Festival. I mean, they're very temporary structures.
Yeah. And so the guy goes, is this area going to be a little more developed? And Elon's like, oh, yeah. But he's like, we realized it would take too long to build the buildings, so we just started building the rocket.
Weirdly, that makes sense. Also, to convey what the rocket reminds me of visually is if you saw the movie The Aviator about Howard Hughes, there's some prototype ship that airplane that he's trying to fly. And there's a version that is almost right, but then he realizes that all of the rivets on it are screwing up the aerodynamics. And so it's like, you could tell it's the same plane afterwards, but then he, you know, has all the rivets kind of ground down and smoothed out. This is the riveted version where you're like, yeah, it's kind of there.
That was exactly the reference I was thinking about in my head looking at this, was that scene in The Aviator where he looks along the rivets and stuff. So yes. And so what they're going to do is in the demo, you'll see actually from the aerial style, you'll see there's a big cylinder on the ground. And so what the next step is, they're going to get the much larger spooled steel, pull it off of the spool, and just use one weld per ring and do that. And they have, remember we saw at the factory, those friction stir welders. We saw the amazing welding machines they can. So next generation.
That's a term that I'm not accessing right now. Friction stir welders.
So what a friction stir welder is you take two pieces of metal, and then you have like a tungsten tip or something go back and forth on it really fast and create friction, which then melds the alloys together. It's how they weld the SpaceX stuff together. They use them for some of the parts in the Tesla. And so it gives you a much better weld, a much higher precision weld between two materials.
Got it.
So they have all these great techniques that they'll be using to do it. And the plan is this version is designed just to test, you know, their flap system, the aerodynamics and the landing of the engine. So it'll go up to that. They have one they're building, the Mark II, which they're building in Florida. That'll do that. Then the Mark III, which they're building this thing simultaneously, you know, are going to be starting them. They're going to that'll be the one that'll probably go orbital. You know, Elon says they think they're going orbital next year. And next possibly year. Even crew. Somebody said, what up, crew? He says, Elon has been very, very happy with the praise. You know, he says it's the best design decision he's ever made in his life. And it's just accelerated things tremendously.
All right. But on a scale from one to the timeline has been elongated, where is this is going to go orbital next year on Elon Musk's
time? let's step outside of the Elon Musk filter and instead let's do the sensible podcast host filter.
This is like knowing him, like he always overstates his timelines, and I think he believes them at the point that he says them, but he also is somebody that has he's realistic in that if something goes up and it goes wrong, then it sets his company back a year and a half.
He describes his time frames as aspirational. Ideally, this is the way these things would go. I would say that he has gotten better. And we looked at it was a year ago they said carbon fiber. And here we are a year later and it's shifted. But now we've already watched the Starhopper. Starhopper's taken off and landed. We've seen that happen this year. We've now looking at what we assume to be, and I think they threw a lot of the parts in there and just bolted them in to say, hey, look what we're done, and they're going to take them apart again, and then before they do their tests and stuff. But yes, his timelines are bad, and I think that I would be surprised if they happen in the time frame that he said, but I think his timelines have gotten better.
Yeah, and even then, you could do worse than on your entrepreneur report card have pretty much one black mark on, and that's deadlines. Like, you still turned it in, just a bit after schedule.
Yeah, I mean, and also it's like he's not doing, I mean, I guess with Tesla, he's doing a consumer-facing item, but like for SpaceX specifically, he's... it matters that you get it right more than you get it on time.
In any event, it's exciting. If you go over to the page and you take a look at the specs on Starship, this is a beast. This thing's going to be taller than Saturn V. They're hoping to be able to launch from these from both Boca Chica, which is going to be their own spaceport, and Canaveral. And the, you know, this is going to have, you know, this is what they want to transition everything to. They, instead of doing Falcon 9s, they just want to use this. The capability for the amount of tonnage this could put into space is insane. The payload capacity of this is basically, you know, one international space station.
I got a question. The Starship, as we saw it alone, we know we're going to see a test flight where it'll go up however many miles and then come back down. But we also talked about how Starship just by itself, you can't put anything in it, but you could get one up to orbit. But is that enough that without a booster, a Starship could be that 15-minute journey to Japan that we've talked about?
Suborbital, possibly, because they asked him about it. Certainly could go some distance suborbital, but to do the Japan journey, I think you're going to want the booster because you want to go into space to do that. They asked him about, oh, could this do single stage to orbit? And he, you know, and Elon, my answer was like, well, no. And then he starts the spreadsheet that he looks at in his head. He's like, well, you know, if we did this, we could, but then it'd be up there to have no fuel and it really wouldn't be worth it. And his mind too is like, the boosters are the most reliable thing they've done so far. Getting boosters back to Earth or something, they've broken a few and they've learned a lot about doing that. And in his mind, it's like, why not just use a booster and get the whole thing back anyways? Because you could put it into orbit. When we talked about this before, like you know, the value of scoring points or not scoring points, you could get into orbit, but if you wanted to get it down, you still have to refuel it, which then means using a booster and another Starship.
Right. So. Well, and plus also when you reliably are able to recover all of your boosters and reuse them, suddenly that becomes a, you know, or we could add 3% to the budget of this thing and use a booster. And then it's like, okay.
Yep. They talk about the presentation too. He's thinking on, because they talk about like the reusability rate. And he's like, well, you know, we'd be able to reuse the booster like 20 times a day, you know? And then he's like, the Starship, you know, it's funny because you watch him all of a sudden, it's like he forgets who his audience is. And he's like, well, Starship, you'd only be able to use like maybe 6 times a day because, you know, if you think about an orbit, you know, unless it's a polar orbit or, you know, unless it's an equatorial orbit, it's a geostationary orbit, it's actually a sine wave, which just means to catch up to that orbital pattern. You know, you're like, okay, we get it. We can't use, you have, it takes 4 hours to get to where you need to go and then come back. Okay, cool. You know, but he's thinking about building fleets of these.
I really adore the fact that, you know, one of the things when somebody's a new media creator, and maybe this is more of an after things topic, but I talk a lot about like, what is it people are really buying? What is it that really matters? Like when you're at the point where you realize what people really want is rockets, all of a sudden, a bunch of obvious things like there should be buildings for our employees. Then it's the crazy people who say, I don't know, should there? Seems to me like, we want to make rockets. and is building a building absolutely necessary to build a rocket? I'm not sure about that. And I'm sure a lot of people on the outside are going to go nuts over that kind of decision. But I love, you know, pass or fail, that people are at least, you know, taking that jump.
There's certainly a book to be written about the evolution of Elon Musk, where, you know, the things that were pivotal towards him. When the Model S came out, it was a huge success. It was the thing they said they couldn't do, and they pulled it off. And they, in their first time out making a mass scale car, luxury car, won tons of awards and accolades, and it was just this blew people away. So Elon then is like, I'm going to go up this. I'm going to build the Model X with gold wing doors and wait and see what we're going to do now. He introduced several layers of complexity, and that was that was problematic. The Model X early ones had a lot of problems. And he talks about like how they were just too ambitious. And a lot of people like me, I look at it like, I don't see the difference, but I appreciate when they say that internally, the things they tried to do made things so much more complicated. And that was a big problem. And I think that he learned from that. He talked twice. He said, well, my new motto is, if the schedule is too long, it's wrong. If it's tight, it's right. And so that's what he said. When we come up with these plans, if it seems like it's going to take too long to do it, he's like, that's wrong. And I think that was, in, you know, the idea of like, well, hey, we could weld this outside and build our airframe to get this thing tested. And he's like, yes, you know? That, and so
that is sort of a bit of the Apple aesthetic as well, or the Apple direction. Like take the fact that only now are we getting a version of an Apple Watch that actually displays the time all day long, or at least 18 hours of the day. Like they knew to just say no, where it's like, yeah, we know everybody would love a watch that's on all the time, all day, and able to track all that stuff. We could get there eventually. But although I say that, but then meanwhile, Apple TV has taken over a decade and is only just now getting around to some kind of official launch. So in that regard, Apple's being very un-Apple. But yeah, I think there's a value to ship with what you have and then figure the rest out.
Yeah, and there's also, you know, a lot, there's a bigger discussion too about how there's companies and then there are projects. And you know the priority of a company by which talent they throw at something, you know. And sometimes they like, yeah, we'll keep X number of people working on things like Apple TV. But like, I remember the Apple TV was, I got disappointed when Apple went on there and they had somebody talk about for 5 minutes about the screensavers. And I'm like, yeah, well, this is a bit of an underdeveloped project. But then you have other things happen, which we could talk about the Oculus announcements too, where you go, man, this sucks. Then you find out why something sucks. It's because they moved the entire team to a different division that's got something better, but they didn't tell you. And you're like, why does this suck? But if you go down to the bottom of the spacex.com/starship page, you can see some of the examples of the overview, and they show you the different uses for it. And there was some stuff that wasn't in the presentation. They show like launching satellites, and they show if I'm not mistaken, the payload they show coming out of there, I think that's like the James Webb or one of the NASA space telescopes. But they're showing this massive, you know, payload coming up. So they're going to build, because they've lowered the cost of building these things because of the stainless, going to the stainless steel, that has a big impact. And it means that if you could build it, you know, cost you 30% as much or whatever, your engines still are the big limiting factor, by the way, is going to be producing engines, because the booster itself will have like 43 engines. But you know, but then again, it's like, we watched the Falcon Heavy take off now 27. And that was the big question. Can this many engines work? We've never had this many engines fire. Now the Falcon Heavy's done that reliably a couple times, but you look at, we're seeing one version of this has this sort of chomper mode. So this would be different than the passenger one. So the idea is, you would drive out there and you would see a fleet of these with, you know, some are designed to carry satellites, some are designed to carry fuel, some are designed to carry people, some are going to be Elon's private party palace, you know, and so it's neat to go look there and see the different missions, the different capabilities they show. They show that, look at the one where it docks next to the space station, and you realize like, what's docking with what? This is really huge.
Yeah, dude. By volume, it looks like it's roughly the size of the space station.
It actually has probably the same interior volume. So there you go. That's the Starship. I highly recommend checking out the presentations. I know I say that a lot, but I do think that, you know, if you were to look back, you know, when people passed protocols for like, you know, World Wide Web traffic, or, you know, Tim Berners-Lee's like, hey, I've got a different way to display documents on the internet. Like, whatever, nerd, you know, and then 20 years later, it's an indispensable part of our life. And sometimes it's hard to think, well, how would space be this? Because I don't want to go to space. It's not so much just the idea of going there. It's the commercial activity. It's the technology. It's the materials technology. It's the science. It's this big other factor that, you know, plays into, like, I'm not a geologist, but geology plays a very important role in my life from, you know, all sorts of things. So exciting. And so just the time, let me go through the timelines again. Next month to 2 months, they hope to do the test, the Mark One, the one we saw. That's the goal, is to do that. 6 months to a year, they want to go orbital. And so, and possibly even have crew, which again, we timelines, but that is the plan, is that, you know, next year we should see this thing go into space. maybe. And then we'll see from there. How this changes everything too, because NASA's watching this. Half of NASA's worried because they're involved in programs involving the SLS, et cetera, which is still moving along. And half of everybody else is like, we're tired of waiting. We want something really cool now. If we have this capability, this is a big game changer. And, you know, what is the world like when you could do a space startup? You know, when you could realistically kickstart an experiment to send you and your friends up into space to do some chemistry experiment or some fab thing or whatever. You know, what is the world like when, you know, we could kickstart our own satellites and other stuff, or, you know,
well, I got bad news for you, Andrew. You don't need to go to space to change the world. We've already got people changing the world right now.
Yeah, patreon.com/weirdthings is where you go to support this show. That's what you do. Type it into your keyboard and then hit return, because this is the adventure of a lifetime.
Oh my gosh. Imagine the smug satisfaction that you're going to have walking down the street, feeling like you're 20 feet tall, giving the middle finger to Elon Musk. I don't see Elon Musk as one of our patrons at patreon.com/weirdthings. He's not keeping us loud, live, and independent.
No, he's over there building rockets. So, I mean, basically six of one, half dozen of the other when you become a patron at patreon.com/weirdthings.
Yeah. In fact, I'll bet he's some kind of sucker that listens to two separate RSS feeds, one for After Things, one for Weird Things. Not one of the cool people who gets it all in one feed and gets stuff early. So know that you get access to After Things before Elon Musk. Take that, Elon.
Dude. You know what? I'm going to add to this offer. When we build our spaceship, Starship, free rides for all listeners. You have a guarantee. When we build ours, free rides for everybody.
Yeah, true. Absolutely. Fact. I don't. Oh, what's that, Elon? You say that's not cost effective? Oh, take it to your shareholders. Why don't you commiserate with Starman over that? We love our audience more than you do, apparently.
Yeah. Spike the football on Elon Musk's face. Go to patreon.com/weirdthings right now.
I love science, but sometimes I feel like the job of a scientist is to stay up late at night and go, how can I terrify people?
Nope, that was Michael Crichton's job, but very close.
Oh, right. I want to scare people. How may I scare them today? And remember we talked about Planet Nine, the idea that way out in the outer edge of the solar system, there may be a massive body which is basically slightly changing the orbital path of things, like in the Oort cloud or the Kuiper belt, like where I think the Oort clouds were seeing these things seem to be looking like they're being pulled by some sort of attractive mass out there. There's something there, maybe, you know, something that could be like a Neptune sized mass, you know, another planet maybe that's way out there. That's hard to see because we don't know specifically where it is. And it's like trying to find, you know, flecks of dust without knowing where to look. Right. Which is cool. And there's some arguments that are like, oh, well, maybe it's just something else, you know, maybe something passed through. Like, we don't know what it is. We haven't seen conclusively any evidence of a planet there. Could be, but it's just really hard to find. And that'd be kind of cool if we do. But somebody else has said, hey, we got a theory for you. What if it's not a planet?
I was wondering about this. Like, what if it's like just a collection of, but if it was a cloud of big asteroids or gas giants, you would think that it would spread out into a ring around the whole solar system.
So what if it's something else that's able to hold its structure, Brian?
Oh, like an alien craft? It could be like an alien megastructure just hanging out watching us.
What show do you think this is?
Sorry, I didn't mean to go to stray outside of the sensible solutions.
What frame of reference do you think I was inside my head that I didn't share with anybody? No, I got better.
What is that?
Tiny black hole.
Now, okay. I hear a lot of things about...
I was on board my alien spaceship idea, but now...
I hear stuff about black holes that reminds me that I know very little about black holes. I think of black holes as, you know, super dense, you know, you got a Jupiter collapse down or whatever. But then I also hear about tiny black holes evaporating, which sounds crazy to me. The idea that tiny black holes exist and then break apart and wisp away. And then I hear that, oh, we don't have to worry about faraway black holes swallowing our planet because their gravity well is very specific and doesn't really affect us. I mean, outside of like the supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy. Like, what am I not understanding about black holes?
Well, Brian, I don't know. I know that it's almost like there's a branch of physics where people ask that question every day.
I was just hoping that maybe you knew a couple of little bits.
You can have things at different scale, and you do get like they found out that like you have edges of it, like you have radiation that's given off, like that was like Hawking, I think, got the Nobel Prize for that. So they can, part of it can radiate away and they can sort of evaporate through that process. But you can have different sizes of this when these things start to condense and get small. And the idea is that you say, oh, it's going to suck in everything. Like, well, if it has Earth-sized gravity, then it's an Earth-sized threat to that. And only bodies that get really, really close to it really have to worry about that, you know. And that's the thing we tend to think of is it's sort of like, this thing is, you know, it's going to suck in the universe. Well, no more than the sun is, you know, whatever an equivalent mass.
It's only going to suck up its neighborhood of the universe, its section. So, like, when we talk about the heat death of the universe, right, I assume that the heat death of the universe looks like all mass has been sucked into some black hole. So all that's left of reality is a bunch of Swiss cheese black holes. Is that correct?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I my understanding is different and not confident enough to say.
Okay, neither of us know anything. All right.
Yeah. So, but as far as the idea of black holes, like you could take the matter in your fist and it could become a black hole. It would be an extremely super, 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 super small black hole and not really pose much of a threat to anything. You know, it just, you know, fall through the center of the Earth and just sort of sit there. You know, we think of the black hole's power is related to how much mass or how much, you know, the mass is there. So a black hole that's, you know, weighs this, you know, the mass of our sun is going to have the gravitational attraction of
our sun. Yeah. So in other words, like imagine all the planets are orbiting the sun. Suddenly you get a telegram because it's the 1800s that says this just in, sun now the size of a golf ball. And you're like, what's changed? And then it says nothing. Stop. And then it says, please burn more coal.
It's going to get cold. But yeah, exactly. So, and that's, we're paraphrasing, but that's basically the idea is that it's whatever the mass of it is, that's, it doesn't increase its gravitational attraction. You know, and so it's just the same thing, but it's a much smaller, denser thing. And that's what makes it scary because, you know, you do have super massive black holes, which if, you know, the mass of 1,000 suns, and that's pretty intense. So the idea here is that you have something that's maybe a thing with a mass of Neptune, but, you know, size of a bowling ball or whatever that's out there that's this attractive thing. So again, it's, you know, the it's a theoretical paper. It's not necessarily put out there as this is what we think it is, but it's like, let's entertain the idea that there is a black hole at the outer edge of our solar system.
If there can be small black holes, do you think it's possible that black holes, that antimatter is like very small black holes?
Well,
is that anything?
Antimatter specifically, if that were true, you would see annihilations all the time. Because whenever matter connects with antimatter, there's an annihilation and a release of massive amounts of energy. Mm-hmm. So now, in theory, correct me if I'm wrong on this one. If there's entire galaxies made of antimatter, then there would be antimatter black holes, but they would be very, very far away.
Well, think of a black hole as more of a property that happens of matter, of the idea that when you get a certain, because like the way they're going to actually look for this is because on the edge of the edge of black holes, you get antimatter collisions. You get regular matter and antimatter collapse and give off gamma ray bursts. That's how they're going to look for it. And that's one of the ways we detect black holes is we look for the collisions of normal matter and antimatter around a black hole. So think of a black hole as a thing when you have anything of enough, anything that could be any sort of property that has mass is able to collect together in a large enough space, you could get then a thing that basically folds onto itself and creates a singularity. So we see the properties of antimatter around black holes. So,
okay.
No.
And if, man, have we talked about antimatter on the show? Because I know that we all have very limited understandings of it, but as I remember from my high school physics or a little bit of college, basically at the creation of the universe, could have gone either way. All atoms could have been made mostly of protons or mostly of, was it electrons or either one charge or the other. But basically it was a coin flip, and the vast majority of the universe happened to come up tails instead of heads. And a lot of the particles that came up heads immediately collided with all the tails particles. And so so as a result, there's very, very little of antimatter out there, although it is possible that there are giant chunks of it out there, in which case it would be the most efficient and powerful source of energy in the entire universe. Am I on track with that as I understand it, Andrew?
Yeah, I think that was, that's the, there was like that balance, but then it, we ended up on one side, And you get that weird thing too that comes up, like the chirality of like certain proteins and stuff and other things, where it just sort of went one way. And there's probably a very fundamental reason why that we're still trying to figure out. Antimatter is a very interesting thing because it's a thing that we're now, it was one of those things that was super, super, it was theoretical, but then the idea, well, we know this thing's real. We've observed it in a laboratory, but it's not a practical thing. Now we're actually in the laboratory producing antimatter. And now there's even companies working on antimatter containment systems because it has advantages for, like, if you want to produce super high energy, energy beams, things like this, they could actually be used for like cancer treatment, et cetera. And it sounds crazy that antimatter could be used for stuff like that, but it has this, potentials for that. And so there's companies working on improving antimatter containment systems.
And so an antimatter containment system would be some kind of vessel that there's a vacuum in there. There's a few, we're talking like atoms, molecules, or I guess literal handful of atoms, but they're contained in like a superconductive magnetic field, right? So they're sort of balanced in the middle of nothing inside of a box.
And it's a minuscule amount, but we're still learning how to produce it. And then, it occurs naturally. It's one of the things that, if you're looking for a far off space economy, is that, on some of your bigger gas giants and stuff like this, as the sun basically blows off solar winds across the solar system, you get areas where antimatter collects. There's antimatter in orbit around the Earth. There's certain belts and stuff where we have it too. It's just not a lot of it.
So crazy.
Yeah.
Man, space antimatter be upside down. What are they? Antimatter. They're the Australia of matter.
Weird. And there are a lot of like fundamental questions about antimatter we're pretty sure we have the answer to now, but even up until recently wondered, like, hey, does gravity affect antimatter the way it affects, what we consider regular baryonic matter, And we think, like, yeah, it does. But we had to still sort of build experiments to sort of test for that because, we can't make all these assumptions. So it's cool. And it was a confusing plot point in Ad Astra.
Oh, so you did watch Ad Astra.
Yeah, we talked about it before.
Okay, all right. I didn't know. That's right. It was Justin who hadn't seen it. That's right.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. Yeah. So Tesla pushed through an update. Tesla, the latest, I think it's 10.0 software update. And one of the features it has on there is Smart Summon, which I have a friend who's on the beta who's been able to use this. So Smart Summon is, you can stand, stand out in front of a shopping mall, press a button, and your Tesla will back out of its parking space, slowly drive through the parking lot and pull up in front of you, and you can hop in, which is great.
Oh my gosh, I'm already buckled in for all of the YouTube videos of like people freak out when car drives itself.
Well, there's that, and yeah, a lot of times like people are using in busy parking lots and stuff, and you're seeing videos uploaded of that's like,
oh,
no, Tesla.
Oh no, oh no, oh no, oh. It definitely just drove into
it's no worse than an old lady driving.
Yeah, so we just watched a video of a Tesla approaching towards somebody else in an intersection, and then another car, somebody just racing through the parking lot, not really paying attention and deciding to stop, so nobody got hurt. But, it's still, we're going to see more videos of this as people are using their remote-controlled cars in parking lots.
I'll tell you what, man, if I'm Elon Musk, I'm like, as many of these videos as you want, post them, get them out there, because what I love about these videos is notice the lack of anybody being hurt, injured, or dying.
Yeah.
I mean, my feelings would be hurt if I used this feature and then somebody dented my Tesla because it drove into a...
Well, we saw a video. We have a video of somebody's Tesla backing up, then some other car backing up into them. And it looks like it was the other car's fault. But, you know, how do you explain to your insurance company?
Yeah, right. Is that covered?
I can't decide if parking lots are the worst place to start instituting this due to the lack of set rules, or the best place, because everything is happening very, very slow and everybody is sort of negotiating. Parking lots are one of the few times of driving that nobody's really running on autopilot. It's one of the few times that drivers are fully engaged, scanning, looking for pedestrians, looking for children, looking for baby carriages, looking for other cars who are clueless. None of us really have any respect for what lines are painted where. So maybe this is the right trial by fire.
So for those of you who are just listening, we're watching this video of a Smart Summit where the Tesla just keeps pulling out, but there's a truck that kind of came up to it, and the Tesla keeps trying to give the truck an opportunity to go by, but then when the truck does it, it pulls out further as if it's going to go, but never goes, and so now it's just back and to the left, back and to the left.
But that's all, like, in a world where machine learning is now able to give us, you know, deep fakes, I gotta feel like they're gonna be able to deep fake the way drivers sort of negotiate with, oh, are you going? Am I going? Oh, you definitely are going right now.
Yeah, they're, and it's like you had a situation here where you watched, this is a big truck, like with dualies, whatever, that went to go turn a corner, which meant that basically it's in the middle of the road. It's at both sides, right? And so the Tesla's faced with this thing where it's thinking, in a properly ordered world, this car would be on one side, not here. And now, and the driver of the truck's like waiting for the car to go, even though he's that situation where you're trying to pull in and somebody's blocking you because they don't realize how far over they are, which is a real situation that it has to prepare for. So the beautiful thing is you get a ton of data from this. You're going to get a lot at Tesla. There's people at Tesla that handle all of this sort of data of like, what went wrong here? Went wrong. How do we improve it? So expect a new software update in a couple weeks that's going to learn from all of this.
Yeah, but even then, it's remarkable that it works even this close to well.
Yeah, yeah. So
that's awesome. You know. Hey, yeah. So I got my kids to watch War Games over the weekend.
Uh-huh.
It was a lot of work. Not so much to get them to sit down, but every 5 minutes to explain what a rotary phone is, what a modem is,
what Russia is.
Yeah, what the Cold War. To explain what the Cold War is, to explain the existential threat of thermonuclear annihilation, to explain the chess game and the tipping point, and to explain how AI, voice speaking AI independent sentient robots weren't a thing back in 1982 or whatever. They were polite and ended, but also unimpressed with the spectacle of the war room, unterrified of the existential threat of nuclear annihilation. It was really a bizarre, wonderful experience. They did relate to the golden retriever and the grossness of buttering your corn with bread. When the dude spreads the butter on his bread and then rolls the corn.
That's smart.
I know, smart, it is. It's a nice food hack.
That is smart.
How did it go compared to how you would have expected, Brian? Like, did you go in thinking that something would play that didn't?
I didn't. Very early on, I realized how little cachet war threats have to somebody who hadn't experienced the Cold War. These kids, they've got no memory of it. It's got no bite. And we experienced the same thing when I showed my daughter The Hunt for Red October. Like, she thought it was cool. I get, like, you know, she's like, oh, I guess there's a special sub. And the one group of nice people are trying to give it to the other group of nice people. And it's like, no. It looks like there's no understanding of brinksmanship or being poised at the edge of the universe. It's really fascinating. And look, I'm not going to say that I wish we could go back to the Cold War, but it is fascinating and wonderful to see children growing up. And we saw the same thing in the James Bond franchise. I remember a couple of the worst Bond movies were right after the Soviet Union collapsed because it was like,
So who are we afraid of now? And we're drug dealers? Arabs? Yeah, you know, it's pretty wild to watch all of that change.
Well, not only that, you had the James Bond movies were like, who are we afraid of now? Like, because the Russians are clearly our friends, will never be our enemies now. And then China, those wonderful people over there, poor people there, they'll never threat. And then like, oh yeah, sex is bad. Like, we're gonna have the monogamous James Bond. And it was like, no Russians, no sex. We're gonna dial back the drinking. It's like, why have James Bond?
Yeah. That's literally like the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost of why we watch these movies.
Yeah. In the chat room, JKing206 says, the kids grew up in a perpetual war and a nebulous enemy. Part of the problem with that is like, yeah, that means kind of no rules. Basically, you wait for lightning to strike. It's like being at war with a lightning storm. You could shake your fists and you could shout about how we will never stop being prepared for another lightning strike. And then it slaps you like, ah! And it's like, well, you'll never get that place again.
Well, yeah, because it's been an era of what has felt like a very secured war, right? Like, there's not the same threat that it felt like during the Cold War, right?
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.